But the key point of the model is that try as much as they could, they couldn't get their model to give the result they wanted. The whole work was aimed not at finding what was going to happen, but getting a result. Full employment, we've got to crank our model. It wouldn't work, so they generated full employment completely by an additional capital investment. If you have a model and you throw money into it, just you make it up and put it into your model, you'll create full employment. So the model was pretty fake. And just a note, with their talk about full employment and all this great future that was possible, unemployment was up to 11% in 1991. I guess what I want to emphasise here is that the work which had built on very many models which suggested the world was heading towards deep trouble was rejected and ignored, and instead work was generated which suited the government, which suited big business, which suited whoever was paying, to suggest quite the opposite, that we were fine. And because of that we're in quite a mess, because skeptics, I looked up the website, one thing that skeptics do is criticise shonky science, and I'm going to ask, where's the shonky science? Because I've suggested that the limit to growth is holding up pretty well on a scientific test, and I'm suggesting that the work from the Planning Council, and I don't think it's a particular daft example, it's quite typical, it just doesn't hold up on any scientific test. By the time it was published, the data and the model were just miles apart. I've already mentioned, and I guess I want to emphasise this, in Australia they didn't destroy their society the way that New Zealand did after the coup of 1984, the parliamentary coup. So they still have a CSIRO. After the Second World War, when scientific establishments were being set up, scientists from all the Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand were talking to one another and setting up good scientific establishments. We had a fine DSIR. And in fact, back in 1972-73, when the Limit to Growth came out, the Royal Society produced a report which suggested there was no problems, Limit to Growth was not a good model. And those of us at Applied Mathematics Division disagreed with them, and we had that freedom back then. When we discussed it, the director said, go ahead, a couple of you. You can put half your time, half your work time, into studying this model and seeing what we think of it. That freedom is just taken away now. So New Zealand science is really in a straitjacket of control and gutted. And, of course, I should be justified in feeling bitter about that. My whole career is gone. I started a career in futures research in DSIR, went over to Europe, where I worked for UNESCO, UNU, OECD, talked to people at the Club of Rome, at different countries, came back with a fair bit of knowledge, and it's all been lost. I think there's quite a subject out there that has been lost in New Zealand, and it's becoming quite serious as we drift towards 2030 or so. The country is ignorant, and the human cost has been enormous. There's been a crushing of the scientific spirit. If you talk to scientists, of course I haven't interviewed huge numbers, but I've talked to a few scientists, they are very, very despondent at having to spend up to half their time preparing proposals to book funding instead of getting on with their work. And other scientists are told, you mustn't say this, you can't speak about this, and so on. A particular little example, down on the south coast, some people wanted to put up a fish zoo, they called the Marine Education Centre, and people at NIWA, some people at NIWA did some work for them, so other people at NIWA were told not to speak out because they might voice the opposite opinion. You've got these controls which have spread across science. Well, I guess I hope that some people will take a much deeper interest in what's happening, because climate change, which is so much in the news today, is just one part of a much bigger problem. And if we think back to that first graph I showed of the world population, we've got to realise just what is happening with a world population that has been exploding all around us, and the world just can't cope. Well, we're called pessimists, so I thought I'd finish with this slide. Last year, a couple of us set up a group called the Island Bay World Service, and we have meetings now and again. And just to show our optimism, we come up with some poems and some paintings which show the sort of life that one could have. And we all know we could have that sort of life. A no-growth lifestyle could be satisfying. Again, it's been widely shown that satisfaction and enjoyment of life increases as you increase your income until you hit around about, 10 or 20,000 a year. It's quite low. It's quite low. And after that, as your income goes up, you're not much more satisfied with life. So the best thing we can do is to spread the incomes. And the painting by Lois White voices some of our feelings, that if we just concentrate on making sure that everybody has a decent house, a decent lifestyle, then we could struggle through. But in keeping with the theme of the talk, I would suggest that that's not going to happen, that we're going to go on into a horrific time. Do I have a few minutes?
You do, you have a quarter of an hour.
I was worried about finishing in time, so I've raced through, and I've got through a bit quickly. So I just make a couple of comments on what we can expect for New Zealand, and then we have any questions or discussion. After all, we live in a particularly privileged position. Even if the sea level rises, it won't destroy our country, as it will some. We are not overcrowded, although we've got quite enough people. I don't know why there's this insistence to fitting more people into a country. I find Auckland horrifying. I don't know people here from Auckland, but I grew up in Auckland. I just won't go back there again. It's just not a good lifestyle. And we also look good to people overseas. So ask yourself this. If around 2030, if in about 20 years' time, you've got more environmental degradation, more overcrowding, if people start starving and rioting, and you've got a lot of money and you live in China, you'll look for somewhere to go to. And that's the role that New Zealand is likely to have at that time. We're the lifeboat. We're going to be one of those lifeboats of the world when people who just want to get away get somewhere. We won't be a place of refuge for the billions of the world's poor. There's too many of them. They won't be able to get here. We'll be a place of refuge for the world's wealthy. And what intrigues me is how little I've just said, because this has been happening for the last 10 years or more. No, longer than that, because it was back in the 1990s that some of us were wanting to stand for the board of Wairarapa Electricity, and we had to find who were the shareholders, the big shareholders, and a huge batch of them were Taiwanese who lived on Waiheke. I mean, people have come over, and fair enough, I suppose, but you've just got to ask where we're heading. So that's our role in the world, and whether we want it or not is one question. A key factor in all of this, which is absent from most of the discussion, is population. It's absolutely fundamental to everything. And we find that as we talk to various people, half people agree with us and half people tell us to shut up. You must not discuss population. I think we should discuss population. We asked a person a couple of months ago who was working on in that area whether there was any population policy in New Zealand. The answer was no. There's no population policy anywhere in New Zealand. That's a key one. Thank you.
Would you just like to take the questions? I'll leave the floor open for
Dr. My hearing's bad.
Okay, so if you have a question, I'll manage it then. I'll get you to stand up, and I'll just keep an eye on you and cue you up. Could you please stand up and speak quite loudly? So we'll start at the front and then to you, sir. Could you speak?
Are there other countries that do have population policies? I mean, China used to, but do they still?
Yes, they still do. We know the Chinese population has gone on increasing, but the estimates are that it would be another 300 million more if they didn't have that policy. If you keep asking detailed questions, you'll find I don't know the answer. I want to emphasise that. I'm not working professionally in this subject because nobody will employ me. We need a team who are working all the time on this, and then we come up with much clearer answers. All these questions, we do need the answers.
All right, gentlemen over there.
Yeah, John, thanks for your book. It was a topic that quite I embraced. We all, as taxpayers, contribute money to organisation, government. Why is it then that you have seen consecutive terms of government, and I go back to the 80s when DSIR was disestablished? Why is nobody confronting ourselves with these issues? Is it the politicians or is it us?
Could I quote Pogo? It's our favourite little quote. We have met the enemy and he is us. It is us, all of us. I have found, I get a bit bitter and twisted at times. I've joined organisations who are concerned about long-term trends, and when I raise an issue, shut up. There's a constant shut up. So, in general, New Zealanders are a fairly gutless, gormless lot who are not prepared to ask sharp questions. When you have a sharp question in the discussion, you look around, you discover it's an American or a Scots or something like this. And I think that I should have a cheap shot at the Royal Society, the scientists, because they've done nothing. They just have done... Some scientists have spoken up, right? So I mustn't say none have. Some scientists have fought against what has happened, but the establishment, nothing.
First of all, I'll just make a quick observation before I ask my question, which is something you're probably not aware of because, as you say, you're not working in this area professionally. The relationship between income and life satisfaction. That's actually out of date now. Research in the past year has indicated that there is actually a steady positive association between income and life satisfaction.
Well, I'd be sceptical about that, and I'd have to read it rather carefully before I came to any conclusion.
Shall we hear the question?
Sure. Yeah. My question is, just going back to the forecasts pulled out by the Club of Rome, I mean, I noticed some interesting ones in there, but I noticed that there were no forecasts of prices, which, if you were looking at whether or not you were going to have shortages of things, would be the thing you'd be most interested in rather than quantities. Was there any particular reason for that?
When you're building a model of the world, you have to make some definite choices. This was a highly aggregated and simplified model with lots of feedbacks in it. But I think that if you read the model and understood what it said and used your head, you would understand that, for example, as oil becomes short, the price will go through the roof. In other words, did they have to have it in there? I've read all those forecasts about an oil peak happening, and the conclusion I came to, common sense I would think, is that the price of oil would go through the roof and become very unstable, and it has been very unstable.
That's my thing.
I'll stop you there, sir. We can continue the debate at the afternoon. I'm on team. Gentlemen at the back there.
Yeah.
Speak right up, please.
I tended to speak, I thought it was more treasury that we run the parliamentary budget. It's been the last 2 years being driven by ideology is not evidence for research on the public sector. My question would be, is the main reason most of the stuff is being ignored is the fact that the people making the decisions tend to be on the latter half of their life, and they're fairly sure they're going to be dead.
Could you hear? Okay, I'll repeat the question. The question was, is the problem that the people who are making the decisions in the latter part of their life, and as a result they don't really care what's going to happen in the next year?
No, I don't think so. It's only an opinion. Our parliamentarians are extraordinarily ignorant because of what they're asked to take an interest in order to get elected. Just the other day, we're at the back bencher along the road there, and the debate was on an H in Whanganui, and the debate was on some rather daft idea the Maori Party's come up with of banning all cigarette smoking. You know, I think the bigger issues around.
Yeah. The question might be, why do we focus on the trivial rather than the big? You were there, yes.
My question concerns the Club of Rome graphs and the predictions and running those predictions on into the future. But, and I may have misunderstood the graph, but from what I could see, the prediction of the relativity between population growth, food production, resource availability was tracking as predicted, and supply was equaling demand. Therefore, in the future, there's going to be a shortage. I don't think that argument follows because supply will equal demand.
You mean you
can prices the
determinant. So you can take the same data as meaning two different things, and then you'd have to study further into what the agricultural experts and the people who are studying food supplies are saying. I think there's a much deeper reason for concern on food than is shown in those graphs, because since 2000 the food stocks have been dropping around the world. And so you do have to then question the model and move outside it and gather more and more information.
There was a shortage of food last year. The price went up. Food production went up in response to the price increase.
Well, one problem with the price of food going up is that some people can't afford it. We've already seen that with the growing crops for energy. That took up some of the food, took away some of the food, and the price went up, and some people have trouble affording it. And this is one of the fears, of course, is that if China does continue growing economically and there's a food shortage, then the people, first of all, Bangladesh will go, and Pakistan, and, you know, Indonesia, all the other people who can't afford it.
Okay, so we can do that, sir, there, and we'll have one more after that.
Three quick comments and then a question. First, I completely agree with you about the collapse of DSIR. And secondly, I strongly agree with you about the poor role that the Royal Society has played in this exercise. My question is this. There is another factor involved in all of this, which I'm interested to know whether you've thought about, but I do know that very, very few other people have thought about. And that is the enormous explosion in the last 5 years in world communication. Marshall McLuhan, a long, long time ago, predicted the concept of the global village. And the effect of this is that people in darkest Africa, central China, tiny little rural villages, who 20 years ago knew nothing outside their boundaries, now know what's happening in New York, they know what's happening if they want to see it on their television in New Zealand. Do you think that that effect of huge increase in international communication will have any effect on the way those models will trace?
No, I think that I've been really intrigued at the lack of impact. Basically, people, if you go back through history, We're still behaving like a plague virus. We're still behaving with no intelligence as a people. And I don't see that spread of information is making any change in the big picture. It's more detailed than the big picture.
And the last question is coming from here.
Yes, at the beginning of your talk, you predicted that there would be some scepticism, you'll be pleased to know that one of your predictions came true. Now, I want to make 3 points and ask for your comments. The first point is related to population. If you look up the United Nations Population Information website, and I could give you the address if you wanted it, you'll find they've come up with a bunch of scenarios dating roughly around 2040. And I know this is not scientific, I can't average scenarios, but the midpoint is roughly 2040, population 9 or 10 billion, steady. Okay? No increase, no fall. The different scenarios are different, but steady. That's not population disaster. That's population stability. United Nations.
Let's have the question out, and then we'll just go with that. Let's have the question.
Well, basically, I'm asking his comment on this because it is quite at variance to his own statements.
The forecast you referred to is exactly the same as previous forecasts. 9 billion is a mid figure for that period. The model suggests that as you are getting towards the 9 billion, it'll all collapse. The forecasts you're talking about are assuming that, taking in fertility and, you know, birth rate, death rates and that sort of thing, and that's been done pretty accurately for many years, reasonable, but there's something new going to happen which is going to break the whole pattern that they're forecasting. So I'm suggesting as we get towards their 9 billion, there will be this catastrophe.
All right, that's all we have time for. You'll be hanging around, no doubt. You'll be able to answer questions during the morning tea. Could you join me in thanking Dr. John Robinson?